This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We start the weekly news review with a look at what went down this week with FC Cincinnati, which parted ways with its head coach. And joining Cincinnati Edition to talk about it is The Athletic and WCPO contributor Laura Faylor. Laurel Faylor. We talked beforehand that I might mess up your name, but it's Laurel Faylor, and I'm so glad you're here with us. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. Okay. And totally understand the
name. Oh, it's so bad. You must have had a heck of a time when that Laurel thing was trending.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I still get called Yanni. So.
Laurel or Yanni, that's the one. Well, look, it was a big week for FC Cincinnati, and this is your beat. You write on the soccer page for The Athletic, and head coach Ron Jans is gone now, and it seems like there's a lot of information out there about what led to this without really telling us a whole lot. So there's a lot of talk. What can you tell us about what went down this week?
Okay, so basically, a few weeks ago, while the team was training in Arizona, Jans made a racial slur in the locker room. He says that he was singing a song, and a couple players approached him and said, "Hey, you can't say that." He thought it was done, and come to find out, last week on Thursday, it became apparent to the club that they needed to put him aside from the team for a little bit and conduct this investigation that a player or players, we're not sure, actually went and complained to the MLSPA, the Players Association. And so that's kind of what happened. Through the process of the interviews, it came out that maybe there were some other things that had happened that...
But we don't know what those other things are, right?
Yeah. Well, we know, we did find out that another part of the complaint was that back in October when the team was playing its finale at DC United, Coach Jans had made another kind of reference to slavery. He, I think, was trying to use it as a story of perseverance, but it didn't quite go over as well as he had thought. He realized that some of the things he was saying that he just thought were normal, maybe other people took differently. So he said he never intended to hurt anyone. He didn't say anything directly to someone when he made the racial slur in Arizona. But it was enough that a player or players complained about it, and that started kind of the chain of events.
Well, what can you tell us about the chain of events? Because it wasn't the team, FC Cincinnati, that initiated the investigation. It looks like it started within the larger league organization, the Players Union, or was it the league itself?
So the Players Association took it to the league, and the league sat down with FC Cincinnati and said, "Hey, you know," I guess the team also realizing kind of what happened, they wanted to cooperate. And so it was a league and team kind of collaboration to investigate what happened. Sunday and Monday, they sat down with some players. I think it sounded like it was some league lawyers that came down to, they're in Bradenton, Florida right now. So that's where all this happened, that they did the interviews, talked with players, coaches, whoever else. It was all anonymous, so no names were put to what anyone said. And by Monday afternoon, the team kind of had the investigation wasn't complete, but they were given kind of a report of what was said. And at the same time, Ron Jans had realized, like, through the questioning that maybe some of these things I'm saying aren't so normal. You know, he felt like he couldn't be himself here, and he kind of saw the damage was done because he didn't know who or how many people had complained. And so it was kind of the team sat down with them, and he decided, "Hey, I'm going to resign." The club was all for that because they just needed to move on from all this.
What was his relationship like with members of the team? Do we know any type of the personal dynamics that was going on between him and the players?
Yes. He came in last year. So basically, to kind of take you back, they started MLS last year under Alan Koch, who had led them during the USL, the final two seasons of USL. And there were some cultural issues that came up in the as Jeff Birding, the club president, mentioned, it was like he had lost the locker room, basically. So he called it cultural issues in the locker room, which was basically just the culture of the club was off the racks, I guess. They needed to kind of get a more positive flow in the locker room, I guess. So they had an interim coach for a while, brought Ron Jans in August, and he was very positive. He's a very friendly guy. People really liked him, and he comes off well to the media. So he brought a lot of positives to the team, but I think there were some people, he, as a Dutch person, kind of that a trait over there is like you kind of just speak your mind sometimes and maybe don't always think of who might be impacted.
And that seems to be what we heard early on, was that maybe this was sort of lost in translation, cultural translation, because he's European and may not understand more subtle nuance about American racism and whether white people should be repeating racist language from black-produced music. You also raise another interesting point that we should explore. It's that Ron Jans is already the second permanent head coach of this very young MLS program. What is the state of that organization now?
Well, I got in trouble last year. Not in trouble, but I called it the situation last year when Alan Koch was fired. I said the situation was – the club was in shambles at that point because they were only 11 games into their first season. They had a chance to start the season right, and maybe they should have – if they – I just kind of felt like if they were going to pull the plug on Alan Koch that quickly, that maybe they needed to do more due diligence before they started the season with him. So now I'm kind of refraining from using that phrase because people didn't like that I was calling it – shambles, but I'm sorry, but that is where we're at again. Right now we're like 10 days away from the start of the regular season, and we don't have a permanent coach for the club, and they have a lot of great pieces. They rehauled the roster, and they've got some great players in, but now no head coach to lead it. So
they do have a rabid fan base, and really FC Cincinnati was the darling of professional sports in terms of the national media coverage it was receiving, it seemed. A lot of success in the lower league that they were participating in, now have moved up to the big league, got a big stadium coming up next to our studios here in the west end of Cincinnati. What has been the response from that rabid fan base? I imagine you've heard from at least a few of them since some of this reporting has come out.
I mean, there's been a lot of It's mixed emotions right now because there are a lot of people that – there are so many positives around the club. There are, like you mentioned, so many fans. They got the stadium, like you mentioned, everything. The roster, that is also positive. But there is a lot of question about Jeff Birding, and just he's made some mistakes that he's even said, you know, I needed a new GM. So he took himself out of that situation last year and kind of corrected that and brought in Gerard Nykamp, who's done a fabulous job rebuilding the roster under extremely difficult roster constrictions based on the league rules and everything. So there, it's just like a mix. I think a lot of people are really just disappointed that it looked so positive going into this season, and now here we are, racial comments getting tied to the team. That's not a good look. Had to part ways with your coach, who you just brought in August to fix cultural issues in the in the locker room, and here we are again with Johan de May as the interim head coach.
For the second time.
Yep, for the second time. So.
And you mentioned that we're 10 days away from the season. Last season wasn't so great. Not unusual for an expansion team in any major league professional level sport to struggle to find their footing in their early seasons. But aside from the struggles with the head coach situation, what's the outlook look like? What type of moves have the team made?
Well, they did bring in two new designated players, possibly a third one. They just signed Seemed de Jong from Ajax in the Netherlands. And he's an experienced player. He fills a big need in the center attacking midfield position. Jurgen Lacadia comes with EPL experience. They brought in a new winger, Adrian, I'm going to say these names wrong, Rigatin.
Look, I said your name wrong, so I can't be any healthier.
So they basically rebuilt the attack, and at the same time, they kind of built back the defense that had some positives toward the end of last year. They added some depth there. And so overall, I mean, the roster just looks set up for success. It's just a lot of the teams in the Eastern Conference also improved. So it's a big question of, you know, with all this uncertainty, maybe some divide in the locker room. I'm not, you know, just there's going to be some issues that come up when you have this kind of situation.
Cincinnati is due for some major league sports success, don't you think, Laurel?
Yes, for sure.
But do you think it will be us waiting until baseball season rolls back around
well,
before we see
the
that?
Reds made a lot of
they've made a lot of changes. People
yeah,
are very excited.
Spent some money, so maybe there's some excitement. We're going to draft. You know, the Bengals are going to get Joe Burrow, as everyone thinks. So
we'll see.
You know, maybe this will all turn out okay.
Laurel Thaler is a contributor to The Athletic and WCPO and has been our guest. Laurel, thank you so much for being here. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And now we continue the weekly news review with an update from Columbus. So joining us is Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter Andy Chow. Andy, always a pleasure to have you. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So let's start with something that we've talked about with your bureau before. Your colleague Karen Kassler was on not too long ago and talked at length about EdChoice private school vouchers. And it doesn't appear that this ongoing debate is not ongoing anymore.
Yeah, and I think the important thing to start off with is that right now the state is kind of looking at a ticking clock, whereas as of on April 1st, the number of schools that could become eligible for its students to then get vouchers will nearly triple in size. It'll go from about 500 to 1,200 plus. And so that's what the state lawmakers are looking at. They want to try to change the process, change the way this EdChoice program is doled out. And what we have seen over the past couple of weeks, what we've seen since Karen was last on the show is that we've seen many, many, many hours of committee hearing meetings. And it's just been sort of this giant wave of people coming in from all over the state, coming to the state house to testify about the voucher programs, about their schools. These are private school students who talk about how much the voucher program has meant to them. These are public school students who talk about how much their public school means to them and why they think that maybe the voucher program should end or change in some way to be able to for their public school to retain more of the money that's coming in from the state. So there's just been an endless amount of testimony provided into this subject. And after all that, we still don't really know what's going to happen. We have House leaders fighting with Senate leaders, and the result is still up in the air.
And it looks like the Senate plan came out of the House, and House Democrats are supporting a Republican plan that's, I guess, emerged maybe from the Senate, Senate Bill 89, and then there's yep. House Bill 9 in the Senate. It was somewhat confusing when I was reading your very good reporting about this because I can't quite nail down exactly where the support is and where the opposition is. So could you help me understand?
Of course, yeah, and I totally get it because, yeah, right now the House plan has been amended into a Senate bill. The Senate plan has been amended into a House bill. So we'll just call it the Senate plan and the House plan.
Okay.
The Senate plan would continue the EdChoice program. So these are vouchers that are awarded to students who are going to schools that are deemed failing. And the Senate plan would make sure that the list of schools would not go up to 1,200 schools. And in fact, it would sort of whittle it down to about 400 schools. But that still keeps some of that EdChoice program in place. And what critics of the program say is that having a school deemed to be failing is sort of a mischaracterization because the thing that's grading schools by many accounts is a flawed grade card system. And so schools end up losing money if a student decides, okay, I am going to what's deemed a failing school, so I'm gonna use that voucher money and be able to go to a private school. And so the Senate plan would keep that EdChoice system in place and just whittle down the number, whereas for the House plan, it would fade out the entire EdChoice program. and instead award vouchers based on income. And that's sort of where the heart of the debate is where should the vouchers be coming from? Should vouchers be granted to students who are going to schools that are deemed failing, or should vouchers be granted to students who are coming from lower income households? And so the House plan would fade out the EdChoice program and raise the threshold of the amount of people who can be who can qualify for a voucher based on income. And right now that threshold's at about 250% of the federal poverty level. So a family of four making about $65,000 would be able to qualify for a voucher to be able to go to a private school. And there has been some discussion between the House and Senate leaders of maybe even raising that threshold to 300%. And that's about $70,000+ for a family of four. So you've got the House fighting on one side against the Senate. It's not really a Republican versus Democratic battle. A lot of Democrats like what the House wants to do, led by Republican House Speaker Larry Householder. He got a lot of Democrats on board to support his plan. Also, basically all of the public school associations, from the superintendents, school business leaders, treasurers, school board members, teachers, they all also support the House plan.
And you reported that it looks like the House has 9 conference committee meetings scheduled. The Senate also expected to start another round of that, and they are counting down the clock until April. I'm sure we will have you or Joe or Karen back on to talk about this before that deadline comes. So thank you for that reporting. I do want to talk to you a little bit about the global trade wars, as they're referred to, coming out of Washington, and how they're impacting Ohio farmers. You reported that it appears Ohio farmers are a little more optimistic now than they were before. Why is that?
Well, listeners, I'm sure remember that in January, the Trump administration signed what's known as the Phase One trade agreement with China to sort of help ease up on the trade war a little bit, to ease up on the tariffs, sort of opening the door back up to trade, which was good news to a lot of farmers here in Ohio who have been facing just sort of this blockade for 2 years now, trying to get their goods to China. And so what we heard from a lot of farmers who gathered at the State House this week, it was a big lobbying day for farmers from all around Ohio to come to the State House and talk to lawmakers. And what we heard from those farmers is that they are cautiously optimistic about where the country is going as far as trade goes. They've been fighting the dropping commodity prices in a tough market, and they say that hopefully things will start to look a little better. What we do know is that China is starting to ease up on their tariffs of U.S. imports, and so we might start to see China start buying more soy, start to buy more pork. And that would be really good news for farmers here in Ohio.
You talked to farmer Luke Dahl. He's based in Montgomery County, where he grows soybeans. And he told you that he's going to plant more soybeans because he thinks the market is going to go up.
He's ready to plant more soybeans, but it's sort of this sort of cautious optimism where he's not ready. Farmers are waiting for a big sign from China to say, yes, we're going to start buying your goods, and then they can start planting. And so at this point, it's like, well, farmers need to start making a decision soon on if they're going to plant or not. So at this point, he says they're not quite sure, and he would like to start planting more. And a lot of farmers, like you said, would start to like to plant more of their crop to get ready for a big export. And at this point, it's just sort of the ball's in China's court as far as if they start to buy more goods.
And Senator Sherrod Brown is still not optimistic, though.
Right. And it's important to remember that Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown has been a big critic of the Trump administration. And he's also been a big voice into the topic of trade. And he's wanted the U.S. to crack down on trade with China. What he's not happy with so far is that he believes in these agreements, it starts to favor the corporations and the businesses more than favoring labor unions, labor groups, and the farmers, especially smaller farmers. And so at this point, I think he'd like to see something that guarantees more habitual trade with China, something that guarantees not just a one-time purchase, but something that can be more of a long-term plan.
Okay, Andy, we're a little short on time, but before we let you go, I'm hoping that you can enlighten us a bit on this attempt to lift the statute of limitations on rape accusations. This is in the Senate, and this might pair with a bill in the House that would let accusers of Ohio State University team Dr. Richard Strauss sue that university.
So what we're seeing right now is that the bill that you just mentioned, the latter to lift the statute of limitations for suing the university, that's a very specific bill written, tailored for the victims or alleged victims of the OSU case. And what people are saying is that there have been other bills throughout the General Assembly sessions here to lift the statute of limitations for all rape victims. And if the House and if the Senate really truly believe that the crimes going on, that the crimes that are alleged at OSU are should and are being taken seriously, then maybe all rape victims should be taken seriously. And maybe the state should lift the statute of limitations for everyone, not just for a single group of people.
And we'll continue to follow that. Our thanks to Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter Andy Chow for joining us. Thank you, Andy.
Thanks.
Why are some local malls in a better position to survive than other local malls? The Weekly News Review continues. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We continue the weekly news review now. I feel like I'm sitting in the WCPO break room because I've got Lucy May. Hi, Lucy.
Hi, Michael.
Lisa Smith. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Michael.
And Evan Millward. Hi, Evan.
Well, hello.
And we're going to get to you momentarily, Evan, to talk about your story analyzing rising home prices in the region's best school districts. But I do want to start with Lisa and Lucy, who worked together on a story about the fact that we've had you on before to talk about that black moms in the area are still dying of pregnancy-related causes at a rate much higher than their white counterparts. And Lisa, your story starts with the story of a woman named Danielle Bush who has a quote in here that just startled me. Having a baby shouldn't be a death sentence. Why does someone like Danielle Bush have to have that worry?
Yeah, well, it's because she's seen it happen. She has some health issues that make it difficult for her to become pregnant and then also places her at a high risk for complications during pregnancy. And so she's seen friends go through complicated pregnancies, have, you know, some, I guess, near-death type of situations, and she just doesn't want that. So what she told us is that right now she's just not willing to take that chance. At the same time, she wants to have a family. She's said she's wanted to be a mom since she was a little girl. She's married now about 3 years, and it's just a really difficult place for a lot of women, particularly African-American women who, according to the statistics, are heavily impacted by maternal death. And Ohio is just now starting to look at this. The State Department of Health did a report that came out last fall, a very wide-ranging report. All 88 counties were included in that report. But they found that the maternal death rate is about 4.7. And so when we say maternal death rate, that is per 100,000 births. But I'm sorry, 14.7. Hamilton County is 14.0. And so it's a growing problem here in the state. They're trying to look at the reasons why. There are a lot of medical reasons. Sometimes it's maybe some of the medical condition of the mother, maybe some pre-existing conditions that she had. But really, more than 50% of these deaths are preventable. And so that is going back to something that's happening with the provider, with the facility where they're having their babies. They're looking at things like hemorrhage that should not happen. Maybe there is a condition that went misdiagnosed. And so they're seeing that. And then on top of that, they're seeing that this is impacting African-American women at a much higher rate. So when it comes to Caucasian women, the rate is like 11.5. Black women, 29.5.
Almost triple. More than double, almost triple.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an 18-point difference.
Lucy May from WCPO, it does look, though, that at least local and state officials are recognizing this as a serious issue, and there appears to be some funding to help alleviate this somewhat?
Yes. Cradle Cincinnati got some federal dollars. About a year ago, the federal government really started to kind of put a spotlight on this problem nationwide and reached out to organizations that try to reduce infant mortality to say, hey, can you make this part of your work too? Obviously, both issues deal with women of childbearing age. So it kind of makes sense that if you're looking at infant mortality, you should also be worried about maternal mortality. And Cradle Cincinnati got a grant that Dr. Elizabeth Kelly, who's a Cradle Cincinnati co-founder and an OBGYN with UC Health, is kind of leading the charge to say, what can we do to reduce these deaths? We especially to reduce the disparity and reach out to African-American women of childbearing age. And so there's a lot of work going on right now on procedures that hospitals can change, that healthcare providers can change, working on implicit bias and some of the issues that people bring into and the baggage that providers maybe bring into the care that they give women that they're not even aware of and how that impacts women's outcomes. And so there is work going on right now. And with any luck, we'll see improvement in these numbers.
And Lucy, you and Lisa also spoke with Dr. Roosevelt Walker. He's the president of the Cincinnati Medical Association. According to your reporting, that represents doctors who are African-American and members of other underrepresented minority groups. He talked about the role of racism in this. Can you explain some of those feelings?
Yeah. He is an African-American doctor himself, and he said he hears it from patients all the time that they go to providers who are, they're African-American, they go to a white provider, and they aren't listened to. Even Danielle Bush, the woman that Lisa was talking about before, when she, this other condition that she has, she went to her doctor, the first doctor she had, and said, I think I have this condition. And the doctor said, no, you're fine, and really didn't listen to her. It was only when she changed providers that she was correctly diagnosed with this very important and serious condition that'll affect her ability to conceive and could affect her outcomes if she does become pregnant. So African-American women especially don't feel heard. And Dr. Walker said that's implicit bias, which is kind of a nice way of saying racism. And it's not always direct and outward, but it's these aggressions that people feel in providers' offices that add to distrust of the system and also mean they're not getting the care they should.
And Lisa Smith, you also reported that there is a response to this by some Black women in Cincinnati and Hamilton County. What can you tell us about Queens Village and their response?
Yeah, so that is an organization that actually stems from Cradle Cincinnati. And they initially were organized to deal with infant mortality and trying to reach women who are pregnant and just basically give them some tools that they need to be able to navigate, you know, through and have a successful pregnancy and successful birth where both the mom and the babies survive. One of the other things that I just want to mention quickly is one of the things that we are hearing from Danielle and some of the other people that we talked with is about the need for people to advocate for themselves. Mm-hmm. That is something that we don't do a lot because we are very trusting of our doctors. And a lot of times we just say, OK, well, if that's you're the professional. And so we're going to just OK, if that's what you say. But then sometimes you just have to hear that other voice inside you or see that red flag, even though it might be very subtle, and just challenge it. And if the challenge is not what you think and you know your body, if you know your body and you know what you're seeing and someone is not taking that seriously, we even heard from Dr. Walker, change your doctor. Mm-hmm. And it's and have somebody there with you. I mean, those are small things that you can do, but they can be really important at the end of the day when you're down the road several months having your baby and things aren't going right.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is a very long story with a lot of detailed analysis, a lot of statistics. It's a very well-reported story that you can read at WCPO.com. It's by Lucy May and Lisa Smith. Let's bring in Evan Millward here, who also had a story this week of interest.
It's tough to follow that, though.
I know. Very tough story. But you followed, it was a very well-done video. You followed a couple looking for a home. And like a lot of young couples who are thinking about children and where those children might go to school, they're looking for a house and a good school district. And it appears that some real estate prices near the region's top performing school districts are pretty much increasing
crazy high.
Yeah. So talk about crazy some of the areas high. You visited.
So we kind of set out to do this because everyone we work with were saying it is really hard to buy a house right now. And it's been that way for a couple of years. But we're talking about houses coming on the market for less than a day. They're sold by the time they come on the market and they get listed. So inventory is at a 20-year low in the greater Cincinnati and northern Kentucky area. So we just, very on brand, we pulled the top 9 school districts. and this has caused some contention, is we use niche.com. They're someone I've seen as kind of an industry standard, but there's also like greatschools.com or something like that. So depending on where you go, they aggregate state, federal data, test scores, and that can be complicated too. So they do some surveys with everyone. That's why we chose niche, to try and mitigate the score, test score issue. I mean, you look at places like Princeton School District that is considered a failing district, but is a very good, has a lot of opportunity. I heard from a couple of Princeton parents about that too. So we took those top 9, and they're exactly who you think they're going to be. Indian Hill, Madeira, Mason, Beechwood,
Fort Thomas,
yeah. So they're exactly who you think they're going to be. Lakota was number 10 because everyone's like, Lakota didn't make your list. It was one out and I just – the 9. So – but if you look at the prices, with the exception of the two districts in Kentucky, Fort Thomas and Beechwood, you could not get a house, a median home sale price below like $300,000, $350,000. And the median's just like right in the middle. So then we were like, let's look at a day in time. And so Valentine's Day was just – it was the Friday before the piece aired. And we looked and we went, let's go under 200 or 250. And like Mason had 7, Madeira had 4, Sycamore District had 2 that were listed on Friday the 14th under $200,000 or $250,000. It's crazy. But it's always been that way. You're always paying more – top dollar for top school district.
I thought it was interesting that the couple you followed around, it looked like they were resigning themselves to the possibility that they wouldn't get a house that they wanted in the districts that they might desire, but they seemed to be considering an investment idea where they could get a house, start their family, and by the time that child reaches school age, get enough of a resale value on the house that they purchase in order to be able to afford maybe a higher price point next time around.
A moment of brilliance from this. They're getting married in July, and they were like, look, we met them at a showing in Deer Park. And they were like, frankly, this is a hot area, and we know that in 5 years, we've got at least 5 years. 5 to 6 years before really
depends
need to be in the
district.
Depends
on how well the honeymoon goes.
Exactly. Yeah. So we'll check in again with them in 5 years and see where they are. They, you know, and it's true. So if you're a young couple and it's a first house and you're getting married, you have some time. They're like, let's get into a hot area, pay a little bit more than maybe we wanted to, but we know that we're going to turn around in 5 years and we're going to make money on this house. And then maybe we can afford to be in the district that we want to be in, which I thought was a bit of brilliance. Yeah. I hadn't thought about that.
Did realtors have anything to say about why inventory is at this historic low, or at least this recent low?
I think it's a lot of factors. I think you're seeing a lot of people and a lot of young people decide they're done paying rent. And a lot of people see it as throwing money at rent, right? Like I could have a mortgage payment for less than rents have risen so much. You could have a mortgage payment far less. And I just think that no one's putting their house up for sale. It's a seller's market. if you have the right house.
Lucy May and I could recommend Taylor Mill Real Estate as graduates of Scott High School, a very fine school that you should be so lucky to attend. <That's right. laughs> Lucy May, Lisa Smith, and Evan Millward from WCPO, thanks to all of you for being here. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks, and the weekly news review continues now with WCPO reporter Dan Monk. He's on the phone with us. Dan, thank you for spending some time with us again today.
Thanks for inviting me, Michael.
Absolutely. You have a great story this week, an iTeam analysis about the viability of local malls and retail centers. And I want to dive into some of the malls in the area that are doing well and some that might not be doing so well. I don't think people in our listening area will be surprised to know that it appears the healthiest shopping destinations in the region are Kenwood and Rookwood. So maybe you can tell us how your analysis confirmed that.
Well, we looked at vacancy rates. That was the biggest factor, and both of those have high occupancy rates in the centers. We also looked at financial metrics, like how much revenue does the mall itself generate, how much revenue do the retailers in the mall generate, and we looked at debt filings, essentially, that you can get online through the Securities and Exchange Commission. And then there are also specific filings that companies have to make when they borrow money through securitized bond deals.
I noticed something in your reporting that isn't really something that I had thought about before. But, a lot of these malls, it's not just national chains that rent those spaces. You do have some independent entrepreneurs who work there. And you talk to Kathy Schwartz. She owns Kathy's Happy Organs and Pianos at Northgate Mall. And Northgate Mall did not fare well. Can you talk a little bit about the unique concerns that someone like Kathy Schwartz has in this changing retail environment?
Sure. I mean, when Sears closed, she was right next to Sears when it operated at the Northgate Mall. The year after Sears closed, she lost 25% of her revenue. And, she's been doing the best she can to survive on lessons. She gives piano and organ lessons. And that's really a big chunk of her revenue now. She actually gets business from the mall walkers who come through Northgate. So, I mean, she's really made an interesting play, to keep the business alive. But she's really worried about what's going to happen when Macy's leaves that mall, because Macy's announced it's going to close its Northgate store in March. So, is she going to have another 25% dip in revenue is really what's on her mind. Plus, a lot of these malls that have Sears and other big department stores that shut down, it's kind of hard for them to gain control of the site so that they can repurpose it. So it might be years before, there's another anchor or something to bring people to the mall in that empty Sears space. And I think that's her big concern right now. How long can she last with declining traffic?
Which mall or shopping area in the region did you determine or find to be the unhealthiest?
The two that are in worse shape are the Town Mall Galleria in Middletown and Tri-County Mall. I mean, I personally was shocked by how empty Tri-County Mall has gotten. I hadn't been there for a couple of years. And the entire Sears and Dillard's wings are almost completely empty. They closed the food court last summer. Their general manager left early in 2019 and hasn't been replaced. And I think city officials there in Springdale are fairly concerned that the mall is not going to be able to survive as a mall.
Dan, I've got 30 seconds left. I want to touch on the Florence Mall. It's in a very healthy shopping area. Florence is a big destination for a lot of retail purposes. But what's the outlook for that mall?
I mean, there's some risk there. They have the same problems that other malls do. However, they've got that insulated geographic area where they really don't face a lot of competition. And they have a lot of drawing power, not only from Northern Kentucky and Cincinnati, but also all the way to Louisville. So I think it's probably safer than most.
Dan Monk from WCPO, thanks for taking some time out of your day and joining us on the phone. We appreciate it.
Thanks.
Okay, and now we wrap up the weekly news review with my friends here at WVXU. I've got Ann Thompson. Hi, Ann.
Hi, Michael.
And I've got Tana Weingartner wrapped in a blanket because it is very cold
it's
in here today.
So cold,
why is it
Michael,
so cold?
I don't know.
All right. Well, hi, Tana. It's good
hi.
To see you.
Thanks for having
Ann,
me.
Let's start with you before we move over to Tana. We'll let her warm herself up before we get to that story.
Okay.
But there is a serious thing going on. Obviously, we're all hearing about coronavirus and how it's impacting the global community. It's starting to impact businesses here.
Yes. So illness aside, the coronavirus is having an economic impact, as we heard at a consumer analyst group of New York presentation in Boca Raton. That's where Procter & Gamble CFO John Moeller spoke about the problem.
And most recently, we faced the demand and supply challenges associated with the coronavirus outbreak. China is our second largest market, sales and profit. Store traffic is down considerably, with many stores closed or operating with reduced hours.
And you're hearing him on a webcast as he said the company, P&G, has been trying to remedy the situation as best it can.
Some of the demand has shifted online, but supply of delivery operators and labor is limited. There are also impacts outside of China. Travel retail. A significant reduction in department store traffic in many Asian metro areas. And a global supply.
So Procter & Gamble, I don't know if you know this, I didn't, accesses 387 suppliers in China that ship to globally, and with 9,000 different materials impacting 12,600 finished products. It didn't say what the products were and what the delay would be, but each of these suppliers face their own challenges.
The operating challenges change with the hour. And, of course, the path of the virus is unknown, making it very difficult to provide precise estimates of impact.
So Procter & Gamble is going to continue to monitor the situation, and obviously the quarter results will be impacted.
It can all be very scary and concerning, but that last comment we just heard seems to be the most precarious because they don't know what's next or when this ends, it looks
exactly.
like.
Exactly. Now, on a more positive note, the coronavirus, you know, all bad, but it is it has raised the stock of one local company, Meridian Bioscience. They're based in Newtown, and they produce and distribute a range of diagnostic tests, and their test is being used over there to quickly identify whether somebody has been infected with the coronavirus.
Okay, so can you tell us a little bit more about Meridian? It's a local company that works.
So it produces and distributes. There's lots of research going on and a range of diagnostic tests all over the world, and so they make this reagent that has been used in fast and accurate screening assays. And the general manager in China, again, the company's based in Newtown, but in China, says that this allows patients to be screened quickly to stop the spread of COVID-19, which has obviously affected more than 2,000 people.
Well, we do appreciate that reporting, Ann Thompson. Thank you for coming in here. I will see you at 2 o'clock because we will be asking
for funds together.
We're going to pitch together.
That's
we're
right.
Pitch together
okay,
for the first time.
It.
I'm looking forward
Thanks.
To it. Thank you for coming in, Ann. And now we turn to the very cold Tana Weingartner to talk about SkyStar, the big Ferris wheel that really quickly became an iconic piece of the Cincinnati skyline. It's going away.
It's leaving.
But only for now.
Well, no, it's leaving for good. But we're getting a replacement.
Yes. Are they going to call it the same thing? Do we know?
They didn't say that they were going to give it a new name, but I guess they could.
Yeah.
I don't know. Todd Schneider, who was with the SkyStar Wheel Managing Partners, spoke this week at the county commission meeting, just kind of giving an update on the new wheel. So he didn't actually say if it would get a new name or not. That's a good question.
How much bigger are we talking here?
So the current one's about 150 feet tall, I believe. The new one, at one point they had said 200 feet tall, but he said on Tuesday this one will be 180 feet tall. Now, what sounds kind of interesting about this one is it's going to be spokeless. It's going to use a steel cable system to, you know, go around the you know, hold it all together or whatever, instead of having spokes. So when it's moving, when they light it in a particular way, he said it'll give the illusion of just being a giant O in the skyline. So it'll kind of look like just a big circle. So that could be kind of cool
it
and
is.
Everything. Yeah.
Did you get to ride it at all?
I have ridden it.
Yeah, I've ridden it too. I rode it a year ago, just before my first show here, because
oh, cool.
I was doing a story about, you know, the regional rivalry between the Cincinnati side and Northern Kentucky side, because we have to bring up the fact
they're getting one
that
too, allegedly.
Newport is bringing a huge one to town as well.
What's the status of that, though?
Well, people ask me about that a lot, yeah. And it's hard to say. What I get from the city and, mm-hmm. frankly, the company is that all the pieces are constructed, and it just needs to be shipped. And it's, I think it's taking the same route as the World Peace Bell, another landmark, another mm-hmm. large piece of infrastructure came up the river. And I think that that's how that's working, too, because like the Peace Bell, I believe it's being shipped up from New Orleans. So okay. we'll have to see.
So they might get theirs in first, then, exactly. because this one, so the current one leaves March 2nd. They're going to start taking it down because it's going to San Francisco, where it's going to be part of the Golden Gate Park 150th anniversary. And then there'll be nothing there for about 6 months, and then they'll start building the new wheel. So that one's not expected to open until, March of 2021. So Kentucky might beat us.
Well, we'll have to see because there's the one I like the companies kind of being snarky to each other when media reaches out to both
we
sides.
We like snark, don't we, Michael?
We like a little shade thrown yeah. every now and then. You know, it's nice to mix it up, and I like that. You know, the one in Cincinnati is going to be a significant part of the skyline. Because mm-hmm. If you're coming up 75, you turn in the cut in the hill, headed to the city. You yeah. see the Cincinnati skyline sort of take over your view, and this. This edition of the Ferris wheel was such a pleasant.
It is. It's really colorful and pretty, and they plan to do all kinds of lighting stuff to it, according to, you know, Todd Schneider. And you can like rent it out for corporate parties, he was saying, and you could do gender reveal parties. They'll have special lighting. You know, I guess you could light it up pink or blue or green or whatever you want to do.
Well, so that's Sky Star in Cincinnati. Yeah. When Sky Wheel opens in Newport, the people behind that say, well, look. You want a view of the Cincinnati skyline, you're going to have a much better one from the Kentucky side of the river. So yeah. we'll have to wait and see how that goes. Hey, I met your mom.
Isn't she fantastic?
She is fantastic.
She thought you were just the bee's knees.
Oh, no way. I thought she was completely unimpressed because she's your mom. And I felt like there's no way I can compete with that. Tana Weingartner, happy Friday. Thanks for coming in and talking to
you're
us.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer of today's show is Elise Meckler. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. You can find archives of our program online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.